Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Tuesday, July 22nd. The on-again, off-again fountaining at Kilauea Volcano has provided quite a show for visitors and residents, and the VOG has enhanced our sunsets, but what about all the gases that come with the lava flows? Do you have to book a flight to see your doctor? Well, a new report out breaks down the problems with medical transportation in rural Hawaii. We hear about concerns over vote counting in the last election on the Garden Isle. And we learn more about what Mark Zuckerberg has in store for thousands of acres on Kauai. Plus, we've been hearing about the plan to build an arch to showcase downtown Chinatown. Well, all the permits are in hand, and now organizers are moving into high gear to bring that vision to life. Tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Kilauea Volcano has been erupting on and off since December, and the most recent episode ended on Sunday after 13 hours of lava fountaining. On The Conversation last week, we talked with contributing reporter Betsy Brown about the dazzling displays, and today, HPR's climate and energy reporter Sabana Harriman-Pope joins us to take a closer look at the volcanic gases and their impact on the environment and our health. Good morning, Sabana.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, I often, worry. I love the sunsets, but yeah, when you think about the folks that are, you know, closer to the volcano, it can impact their health.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to delve into this topic a little bit deeply because I grew up on Hawaii Island, and so volcanic eruptions were just a fact of life. So I wanted to get the details on what it means to have so much exposure to different types of volcanic gases. And I think we should start by just playing some sound captured from the most recent episode of Kilauea's ongoing eruption.
Yeah, windy, scary.
Yeah, so listeners who have just seen videos of the eruption on social media or photos might not realize how loud it is. And volcanologist Patricia Nadeau, she actually compared it to a jet engine. And she said, what's causing that sound and the magnificent volcanic fountains that we've been seeing over the last 7 months is different types of gas.
So it's just like when you have a bottle of soda and you shake it up, the carbon dioxide dissolved in your bottle of Coke or Sprite or whatever. Those gases drive that explosion when you crack open that bottle. It's the same with the volcanoes. It's those gases that are trying to escape from the volcano that drive those big fountains.
So what kinds of gases are we talking about specifically?
So Nadeau says that generally during an eruption, there's a big three, right? Water vapor, sulfur dioxide, and carbon dioxide. And these gases are responsible for these spectacular sights, but they can also be hazardous. And the main one is sulfur dioxide, because that has the greatest impact on residents of Hawaii Island. Sulfur dioxide is what causes fog, which folks on Hawaii Island will be very familiar with. It can cause breathing issues. It can irritate your eyes, your nose, and your throat. When I'm home and Kilauea starts erupting, suddenly everyone seems to be coughing or having like a little bit of a tickly throat. And there's research that suggests that prolonged fog exposure is actually even associated with things like lower student test scores. So the sulfur dioxide in VOG has all these different implications to human health. The other aspect of it is when it combines with moisture in the atmosphere, it can create something called acid rain, and that can damage plant life and even corrode metal.
It can be a problem here in rural parts of the Big Island because so many of us rely on catchment water. So water coming off our roofs, if your roof is rusting or you've got sulfur dioxide dissolving into the rainwater, it turns it more acidic, which then accelerates the corrosion of your roofing materials and things like that. So it can contaminate water supplies on catchment systems like a lot of people here are.
Yeah, because it just corrodes the nails, the screws, that kind of thing, and it gets in the water.
Mm-hmm. And I remember actually when I was working on the conversation in 2018 during the big lava flows of Kilauea, there were experts that you spoke with on the show that talked about how acid rain was causing damage to orchids and papayas. It was burning off their leaves. And at that time, to put a little bit into context how many emissions are coming out of the volcano now, in 2018, Kilauea was emitting over 100,000 tons of sulfur dioxide a day. And there have been days in the last 7 months where we've seen sulfur dioxide emissions reach similar levels. So during these most recent active eruptions, when those lava fountains have been super, super high, they've been measuring emission rates of about 50,000 to 100,000 tons a day.
So how safe are those emissions for the folks that go over to the park?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't want to scare people. Researchers monitor these emissions really, really closely, and the areas that consistently have poor air quality in the park are closed. It's really important to pay attention to the guidance when you are in the park. For the larger community, there are websites that give you in real-time assessments of air quality around the islands so that you can understand where the hazards are present. And the other gas that's in this mix that we don't discuss as much in the context of Kilauea eruptions is carbon dioxide, which folks will know is a potent greenhouse gas that's linked to global warming. And I spoke about this topic with Christoph Kern. He's a USGS research physicist who focuses on volcanic emissions. And he said during Kilauea's eruptions, we're going to do a little bit of math, carbon dioxide is emitted at a 1-to-3 ratio with sulfur dioxide. So we're looking at between 15,000 and 30,000 tons of carbon dioxide a day when Kilauea is actively erupting the way we've been seeing it erupt over these last couple of months. And so globally, volcanoes do emit a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
On an average year, volcanism contributes about 200 to 400 million tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. That sounds like a lot, and it is a significant amount. And over geological times, that contribution has been essential in creating Earth's early atmosphere. Today, however, human activity is putting about 100 times more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. So the current numbers are around 40 billion tons of CO2 per year. And so that dwarfs the emissions from volcanoes in an average year.
Interesting.
Yeah. However, Kern did point out, while, again, human activity produces so much more carbon dioxide than volcanoes, there have been a handful of times during really, really massive eruptions when carbon dioxide emissions from volcanoes have been step in step with human-driven emissions.
The largest eruption in the last 100 years was the eruption of Mount Pinatubo in 1991 in the Philippines. The largest explosive phase of that eruption lasted about 9 hours. And during those 9 hours, approximately 50 million metric tons of CO2 were emitted. Now, if you do the math and scale that up to the rate at which humans put CO2 out, you will find that it's quite comparable. But luckily, we don't have eruptions like that continuously, and in fact, haven't had one of that size since.
So since that eruption put so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, did it have a climate impact?
So it's interesting, right? It's a complex process that's happening here. And you would assume, perhaps, that we would see a warming impact because of eruptions like that. But actually what happened in the aftermath of the eruption of Mount Pinatubo was that global temperatures actually went down by about 1 degree Fahrenheit for a couple of years. And that's because, back to sulfur dioxide, the eruption was also pumping sulfur dioxide into the upper atmosphere. And when sulfur dioxide gets high enough, it converts to sulfate aerosols. And those actually are able to reflect radiation away from the sun away, and they can cause these cooling effects. The other event that might be familiar to folks was a huge eruption in 1815 or 1816, where there was an eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia, and it resulted afterwards in what was known as the Year Without Summer, where we saw global cooling as well. But these eruptions, these cooling effects are short-lived. They're not, you know, making long-term changes to the climate, and they're not enough to reverse the warming that we're seeing from human emissions. And Kilauea its eruptions aren't going to have that effect at all, because the recent lava fountains that we've seen, they're magnificent, but their plumes are nowhere near high enough to get sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere at that level.
Just enough to irritate our throats when we go over to Kona.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, all right. Well, thanks so much, Savannah. Interesting stuff. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pope.
Today on The Daily, in the global fight to dominate AI, China is quickly catching up to the United States, which is why President Trump barred the tech giant NVIDIA until, that is, a few days ago, when Trump abruptly reversed course. I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from HSO's Sheraton Summer Festival, performing Tchaikovsky Spectacular featuring violinist Timothy Chui this Saturday at the Waikiki Shell. Tickets at myhso.org.
An ambulance ride or helicopter flight is what we might think of when someone is traveling to a hospital. The journey to get care and to get it covered by insurance can look drastically different depending on where you live. John Desfor is a co-author of a recent report about rural health in Hawaii. His team at the University of Hawaii Rural Health Research and Policy Center found that barriers to transportation and travel are delaying health care for residents across the islands. He saw it firsthand once while he was waiting for a delayed flight to Lanai, along with a woman who had just given birth. He learned how a doctor visit can be much more complicated outside of city centers. Desfor spoke with the conversation's Laura Dukes about the report, starting with defining a key term, non-emergency medical transportation.
Non-emergency medical transportation is an official term used in this health policy space. It basically means any kind of transportation to a medical service that isn't an emergency. So if it's not in an ambulance or a 911 call, then it's counted basically as non-emergency medical transportation. Day to day, that looks like driving from your house to your primary care physician, or taking a flight from Big Island to Oahu to see a specialty care, or to get chemo, or go to a prenatal visit. It also looks like getting picked up by a medical taxi from Medicaid and getting driven to your appointment, or taking an Uber. It basically encompasses all of those different things. And it is not always covered by your health insurance. In fact, most plans in Hawaii don't cover it. Medicaid does cover it, and that is a huge lifeline for people on the island, and something that the more and more we researched it, the more grateful I was that that exists here. Most private insurers, Medicare does not often cover it. For example, Lanai, there are a lot of people that are privately employed and received employer health insurance and don't receive Medicaid. And those people oftentimes have to purchase plane tickets out of pocket to get to medical care. So it's challenging. And one of our policy options that we did research on and put forth in the report was to look at how do we increase the amount of insurers in Hawaii that are covering non-emergency medical transportation.
I think on that, you offer quite a bit of policy solutions in the report. I think it's whole one section of the report is policy solutions. So I guess for you, what do you think are the top ones that seem easily achievable that we could do?
Easily achievable is a great modifier to that question, because a lot of our options are big stretches, like getting Medicare to cover non-emergency medical transportation. That would be a big stretch at the federal level. Some of the more potentially easily achievable policy options here would be enhancing the Medicaid coverage that does exist. It is a super important lifeline, and it's great that it's covered here. We did hear from a decent amount of interviewees that there were some struggles with that coverage. They oftentimes faced long wait times for approval when they requested non-emergency medical transportation, 2 to 3 weeks even. There was also some issues with timely access to the transportation. So if they called a Medicaid taxi, they would oftentimes, we heard, face long wait times or even the taxi never showing up. And so that's something that working in collaboration with MedQuest and the Department of Human Services in Hawaii, and they have been super supportive of this work and are interested in making it the best that they can. But it gets tricky when you get into the weeds of trying to fix this because those taxis are contracted out. So it's a private company or organization that Medicaid contracts with to provide those. So how do you ensure that they're meeting the standards that you want to see? And even with those contracts, MedQuest uses managed care organizations. So that's like the Aloha Care MedQuest or the Ohana. And they have their own separate contracts with other medical taxis. So you get into all of those weeds. And what we hope with the report is that we can figure out like specific regulation changes to prioritize ways to improve transportation in particular.
Yeah, I think on that, something that surprised me, which I didn't know, was that 911 response operates differently by county in Hawaii? Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Each county operates their 911 systems differently. Maui County, there's actually a cost-sharing agreement between the Department of Health and a contracted group called REACH, Air Medical Services. Hawaii County, it's through the fire department. They respond to 911 calls and operate ambulances. So it's different in every county, which has pros and cons. It allows smaller subsets of people, countywide versus statewide. There's different problems in each county, in each island, so it allows them to tackle those individually. But what we heard from especially stakeholders at the EMS state level is that there's a lack of coordination between the counties when trying to work through transfers between hospitals on Big Island and Oahu or mass casualty incidents where, you know, you have to respond statewide. So we included some recommendations about finding ways to increase coordination and navigation between the different counties.
Can you give an example of one of those solutions or even an example of like why that communication of having it two different groups creates problems?
So one of the solutions that we developed in partnership with the Emergency Medical Services branch at DOH was to look at the creation of a centralized emergency and trauma care communication center. So a lot of times, emergency medical services and trauma systems and injury prevention are in separate categories. So looking at a way to bring those together into a center that also brings together all of the counties to do things like triaging of patients in some of those larger events, determining the nearest appropriate facility. So when you know, there's a 911 response on the ground, where do you take that patient? Depending on how full certain emergency rooms are, or to just take them to the closest hospital or bring them all the way to a level one big trauma center like Queens. So having a coordination navigation center like that to be able to be on call 24/7 and coordinate with the different counties and their response systems is one of the policies that we propose.
How complicated or hard would that be to achieve?
There's actually a blueprint for it. Arkansas did something very similar a few years ago where they implemented this type of center. It would really just require the Hawaii State Legislature to authorize and then appropriate funds to the Department of Health to create that center. And then that branch, the EMS branch, would work to set up the system, hire personnel. So then you get into that costs money, right? And that's expensive. And that's a lot of times with rural health, that's where the block is, right? Diverting money to these areas. So you have to get creative. And with this kind of trauma center, that Arkansas system that they implemented that was similar, due to the increased efficiency that they created, they actually were estimated to save over $100 million annually in state medical costs just by creating a higher efficiency system. So that's there's upfront costs, but then the savings on the back end are what allow it to be financially sustainable.
I know there's been some changes recently and talks about concerns of rural health. Do you have any concerns that aren't addressed from this report or anything that's changed since this report?
Biggest change that I could foresee would be to the Medicaid program in Hawaii. Based on the reconciliation bill that passed, there seems like there would be less funding coming into the state from the federal government. And so finding ways to, like I talked about with that EMS coordination center, it's just about finding ways to get creative and create higher efficiency systems that wind up costing too much in the long run, but still investing in rural communities. So it'll take some creativity, but that's what we hope to provide at least a little bit of in this report and hope to continue working with partners to find ways to make it happen.
John, is there anything else you would want people to know about this report?
My hope is that this report highlights the ways in which rural places in Hawaii deserve access to healthcare in a way that they haven't been getting previously. We talked to someone on Kauai that said, every person living in Hawaii deserves equal access to healthcare. And I think that statement has become something that not everyone can agree on. And I hope that through this report and through hearing about people's stories and what they go through on a daily basis, that everyone, by the time they finish either reading or listening about the report, would be able to agree with that.
Is there like one story or one part of this report that you think would make people like take a step back or think about it differently?
I would go back to Molokai actually, and indirectly heard about a man living there who was getting older and healthcare was getting more expensive and he was having to travel often to Oahu for care. His flights kept getting delayed. He was having trouble getting into the plane. And he said to the person that I interviewed that he is giving up and just wants to die here. It's just hard to hear stuff like that when the system has failed people like that. And my hope is that we can change that. And I know that we can, because rural people deserve to live where they are and still get access to that. I've talked to a lot of people, even some of the interviews we talked to said that, you know, these people living here have made their choice. Like, they know the consequences of living where they live and healthcare is going to be far away. I disagree with that. I think there's so many great things about living in rural Hawaii, and we as a healthcare system need to find ways to get those people the care that they need.
That was John Despore, who spoke with HPR's Laura Dukes about rural health transportation and policy solutions. You can find a link to the report later today on our website. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Fry it, grill it, no matter how you package it, today's quiz is about Spam. The brand has been around for more than 85 years. Many likely know how it exploded in popularity during World War II, when its long shelf life led to its inclusion in the rations of U.S. soldiers. It took hold in the Pacific and never left. Consumers know Spam for its blue and yellow packaging, but other artists have occasionally left their mark on the iconic Spam can. Monty Python's Spamalot released a collector's edition, a golden honey grail Spam can. In 2025, Disney partnered with Spam to release a set of Lilo and Stitch-themed cans, where the blue alien can be seen catching waves beneath the Plumerulae. And last year, Spam released a can featuring the work of a local artist as a special Hawaii Collector's Edition. So, for our backyard quiz, do you remember what local artist designed the 2024 Hawaii edition of the Spam can? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Cuts to federal funding are reshaping the country and putting vital local services, including Hawaii Public Radio, at risk. This is Mary Fasnaugh, board member. 10% of HPR listeners and readers donate to fund HPR's work. Help raise that number so our independent, community-funded nonprofit stays strong now and into the future. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org and click donate.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
Drama at the State Elections Commission? Well, you may recall some recent reporting into some of the dysfunction on the board in the lead-up to the 2024 elections. Well, Honolulu Civil Beat has been keeping tabs on the Election Commission, and today, Civil Beat's politics editor Chad Blair joins us. So what's this about numbers not adding up, Chad?
You know, I agree with you completely about reporting, I think, from you guys as well as Civil Beat about dysfunction at the White Elections Commission. I mean, anybody who's tuned in to watch them, it goes on for hours and hours, and it's a lot of back and forth and not a whole lot of accomplishments. But something happened unusual last week, in which some of the complaints that people have been making about how elections are conducted in the state, in this case particularly Kauai County, saying maybe there's some voter fraud, some of the numbers are not adding up. Well, guess what? The Elections Commission actually put together a group to look into it, to investigate it, and they released a report dated this month that says, yes, in fact, there appears to be different numbers in terms of what was reported by the county. In other words, the votes that were cast on Kauai County for the general election in November on Kauai, and what actually shows up is the official result on the state's numbers. And those difference, that difference is 661 votes. In other words, it increased. Where did those votes come from? How did that happen? We don't know. But this panel has validated the concerns of a number of people, including some of the election commissioners themselves. There's nine of them total who have been saying for years now there's something wrong with the way we count our votes.
Yeah, and when you say state, you're talking the Office of Elections, right?
Correct. And this group interviewed Scott Nago, who's the chief elections officer, also interviewed the clerks there on Kauai County. And according to this report, it's just barely 4 pages long, it's up on the website, could get no satisfactory answer as to why there's a discrepancy. That is the word that was used. And yet they're saying it is serious enough of a concern that the commission is actually going to meet later this month. They're getting together on the 30th, kind of an emergency meeting because they rarely meet more than every couple months or so. And among other things, they're going to talk about having maybe an audit. Maybe there should be an audit on what happened during the Kauai general election. Maybe we should audit not only the Kauai numbers, but what the state reported. And going forward, maybe we need to have observers. Maybe we need to have people in there officially counting the ballots to make sure that we have an accurate number that's fair. And you can imagine what if this was been applied to the other three counties. I should just say that the people that are complaining about Kauai County's votes, that includes Ralph Cushney, one of the commissioners, they have also been complaining about Hawaii County, which is much larger than Kauai. And they say, based on their own data, there is an even bigger voter discrepancy there. We don't know that yet. The commission hasn't formally looked into it. They're considering it. But this sort of just goes back to some of these concerns that have been primarily expressed by conservatives, by Republicans. Can you trust a mail-in ballot? Because that's what we're talking about. It's the mail-in ballots. And today, Hawaii votes overwhelmingly from the comfort of their own home. I do it. I've been doing it for years.
Yeah, I mean, you want to get to the bottom of this. But, I mean, I don't recall there were any super close races there on Kauai.
No, I did take a look at the numbers. You know how it is with the county council. It's like, I can't remember. Is it 7 members, 9 members? There was one, a whole bunch of people ran, and one of those races was within about 106 votes or so, maybe would have changed that. But then we don't even know where those 661 votes, if they weren't in fact cast, if they weren't created out of thin air, you know, what precinct, what district. But no, I remember the results, it's over. The election was certified months ago. I don't know that a court would look to try and rerun an election. I think if they verify these problems, the trick is, the challenge is to make sure it doesn't happen again in the next election.
Right. But you do want to get to the bottom of it, clear it up, figure out, you know, what was screwy there. And just so we can have, you know, the integrity of the election process just hold.
Yeah, and I mean, it is fundamental. I mean, we don't even have to bring up the 2020 presidential election, of which there are still lingering differences, as we all know. But fundamentally, this is core to our democracy. Does your ballot count? Is it possible they were corrupted somewhere? Was there fraud, or was it a technical error? So the commission is going to get to the bottom of that, and for sure I'll be covering that meeting no matter how long it lasts.
All right. Okay, well, keep us posted. We'll stay tuned.
Thanks, Catherine.
All right. That was Civil Beat's political editor, Chad Blair. Look for his story at civilbeat.org. You know, over the past decade, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg has bought more than 2,000 acres of land on Kauai. He has created a compound for his family, which includes building what some call a doomsday bunker. Earlier this year, he quietly made another purchase of close to 1,000 acres of ranch land to add to his holdings. Guthrie Scrimger is a former reporter of the Garden Isle newspaper, and he has an article about the purchase in the science and tech site Wired. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about his story.
So I was a couple years ago working as a local newspaper reporter at the Garden Island. I lived in Anaholo, which is about 10 minutes down the road from where Zuckerberg is building in Kilauea. And what drew me to this story was just the fact that there seemed to be on Kauai hundreds of people that were working on the Zuckerberg property, but who weren't allowed to talk about it, because everybody that works there has to sign a pretty strictly enforced NDA. So yeah, I became fascinated with this idea of there being this huge job site that is totally secret and nobody's allowed to talk about it. I filed a public records request to try to figure out exactly what Zuckerberg was building there.
And so you had one main piece kind of detailing that come out about half a year ago, I'd say. And then this most recent article that you just published gets into unreported purchase of even more land. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the news that we broke this week in Wired was that Zuckerberg, he previously owned 1,400 or so acres of land up near Kilauea, and he just purchased about 962 acres of land on the Mauka side. And we don't know the exact cost. It's not clearly reported in the public records, but one source close to the sale estimated it was more than $65 million.
So a lot of money. And I think the big question that a lot of folks are asking is, what is he doing with all this land?
That is a great question. I can't say for sure. I haven't actually ever been onto the compound, but I have seen thousands of pages of planning documents for what he has at least planned to build there. And there's a lot of interesting stuff. He's building a ton of stuff. There are, you know, I would say dozens of structures on that land centered around these two massive mansions that each or have a total square footage comparable to a NFL football field. There's a massive gym. There's multiple pools, hot tubs, cold plunges, sauna, these weird like saucer shaped tree houses. And then what got a lot of attention was this storm shelter, which between the two main mansions, there is a tunnel and that branches off into this 5,000 square foot storm shelter, which has a blast resistant door and an escape hatch. And I don't know what the intention of that is, but it definitely could read as being doomsday bunkery.
And what would you say to someone who questions why this is all important, who says, why does it matter that one of the world's richest men is building in this way on Kauai and buying it up without really telling a ton of people about it?
Yeah, well, I think for one, it just speaks to the general wealth inequality that exists in the world today. I think it is worth reporting that the billionaires in our society are just able to drop however much, $300 million or so dollars on buying land and building these strange properties. And then there is this history in Hawaii of outsiders going in and buying up Hawaiian land and exerting enormous influence over locals that live here. And I think that this is the latest in that trend.
And one of the things your article gets into is just how the fabric of some of these communities on Kauai have changed because of the massive investment, the jobs that come along with it, some of the philanthropic investments. So elaborate a little bit more. What does that investment look like on the ground?
Yeah, so one thing I found interesting in the article is just that the total spending on Zuckerberg's compound, which we estimated that it's probably over $300 million by now, that is probably more than the Kauai operating budget for fiscal year 2024, which was $311 million. And so when there's that kind of spending coming into a community, it is going to have a massive impact and kind of transform that community. And you do see that in a lot of nonprofits on Kauai that are now like really soliciting Zuckerberg for donations. And he has given a lot of money to the community. He's made a recent donation to a charter school in Kilauea, and he made another one to an affordable housing nonprofit. But some people are bothered by the fact that it is, at the end of the day, an outsider that is making these decisions about what nonprofits get funded and, you know, what community initiatives are going to get funding.
And you reached out to him and his reps for comment. What was the kind of thing that they said back to you in response to your questions?
It was a pretty long response, so I don't know if I can accurately summarize all of it. But their basic take is that Mark and his family have fallen in love with the island, and there was already a development slated on that land, and that he has largely preserved the land. There was a luxury development that would have been like 80 homes planned, and that his development is relatively small in comparison to that one that was planned.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
All right. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, that was investigative reporter Guthrie Scrimger talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have a link to his article on our website. Now it's time to crack open the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we took a look at the blue and yellow Spam can and recalled special editions featuring artistic flair. In 2024, the makers of Span released a collector's edition featuring a yellow hibiscus and a pink Lokelani rose. The flowers were painted by a Honolulu artist who many know as a co-founder of the Pow Wow Art Festival. We asked you to name this artist, and here he is talking about his work with SPAM last year.
I've been blessed to be part of a lot of amazing projects in my career, and when SPAM approached me to do the label, it was probably one of the most exciting feelings I've had in my career.
My name is Kamea Namba Hadar, and I am from Honolulu, Hawaii.
My grandma is very proud of me, and she loves everything I do. Now that I've done the SPAM can, she thinks that I've finally made it as an artist. So I'm happy to make her proud.
Kamea Hadar was the artist we were looking for. And congrats to our winner, Sean McNary in Hilo. You got it right. That's our quiz today. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Honolulu's Chinatown is one of the oldest in the country. And years ago, an idea to build an arch to frame its rich history got some traction. Well, this month, organizers secured the final permits from the city and state to get the project underway. Hawaii businessman Eddie Flores Jr. provided the seed money to get the arch planning and design underway. He's now launching a fundraising effort to see the Kekaliki Mall project through.
I just want to tell people that this is a privately funded event, because we're going to build an arch. That's only step one. Because phase one is to build an arch. If you have gone down to Kekaliki Mall today, you will see the city has done a tremendous job cleaning it up and also put up all the lights and repainted it. We put up some pretty nice banners up there, if you see it, to honor some of the Chinese that has tremendous contribution to Chinatown. In about a month, I think, month and a half, 2 months, we will have red lanterns all around Kekaliki Mall. And even before the arch is being built, I am talking to the city right now to have some murals painted on both sides to depict the history of Chinese in Hawaii. Not too many people know about the Chinese history. Most of them think that Chinese are loaded. They came here with tons of money, which is not true. They came here in the middle 1800s as plantation workers. They work on the field just like everyone else, like just like the Filipino, the Okinawan, the Korean. They work in the field and they made the money. And that's why they're so prosperous right now. I hope they can give me some money.
There you go. The idea is that we need to tell the story of Chinatown. Give it a facelift. We've got lots of synergy happening. We've got a rail that'll be going through there. And it's just important that we showcase that history.
No, we need to showcase Chinatown. Every time I visit a city in the mainland or in a foreign country, the first place I go is Chinatown. And I'm telling you, most of the Chinatown are bustling. Our Chinatown, I visit it about 2-3 times a week. And I notice that there's a lot of tourists visiting too, besides just local people. If you haven't been to Chinatown, please come and visit Chinatown, especially Kekaliki Mall. And the city has done a tremendous job in renovating the area. They have beautiful lights. They have beautiful banners. The people are friendly. If you're thinking about going to a farmer's market, go down to Kekaliki Mall, go down to Chinatown. They have it 7 days a week, starting from 7 o'clock up till about 4 or 5 o'clock. And that place is bustling.
Yeah, you can find lots of terrific deals down there in Chinatown, lots of wonderful places to eat. And we just need to be able to rally the community around to make it a better Chinatown, right?
Well,
a safer
place
for people.
It is. In fact, I just recently talked to this gentleman, Robert Fox, from the Rotary, and he said he has a project to clean up all the graffitis. And I said, wow, that is great. I really appreciate that. We do have other people willing to help. So this is really great. Now, I know the perception is Chinatown has a lot of homeless. It's dangerous. Well, let me tell you this. I live a block away from Chinatown since I was a little kid. I live at Kukui Garden, and nothing ever happened to me. And recently, the mayor even told me that they have cameras all over. They have 51 AI cameras. So anything you do, they'll catch you. plus. It's pretty clean. Every morning I walk down there, they're flushing the water, high pressure water, the pavement,
pressure
pick
washers,
up the trash.
Yes.
The police has great presence. They have a police station out there. A lot of the merchant has a private security guard. To me, it's pretty safe.
Everybody's trying their best to spruce up the place and deal with the problems. We used to have, like you mentioned, a large homeless problem down there.
Not anymore, telling you, because
you
will have one or two cases, people sitting around in the street, but it's not like what it used to be. Back in the old days when we have the River of Life, believe me, I won't even go to Chinatown. There were so many homeless down there. Nowadays, it's different. You might have some people that are mentally ill sitting out there, and the police been telling them to move. I've seen the merchant too been telling them, hey, you got to move. So to me, it's really changed. I'm telling you, I know 2 years ago, it's not the same. Chinatown has really improved. So what I really want to do is, my phase one is really to make Chinatown a destination, and it will happen by summer of 2026. And after that, I would have my staff start working on promoting Chinatown. When I say promoting Chinatown, I'm talking about free walking tours. Well, when I go to Europe, I notice that they always have free walking tours, and you get 30, 40 people there. And we plan to have free walking tours. We also plan to have eating tours. And in fact, I talked to a couple of people already about and put food booth down there, maybe twice a week for the local people or for the tourists. So I'm really excited. But in order to accomplish this, I will be developing a website. I'll be developing a lot of film for YouTube, for TikTok, for whatever I can to promote it. So I'm telling you, by end of next year, 2026, which I will be officially 80 years old. This year, I'm 80, the Chinese calendar, by the way, okay?
Next year,
I'll be officially 80, the American calendar.
All right.
And I'm telling you, you walk down there by end of next year, it's not the same. But I do encourage you to go down to Chinatown. And when you see the mayor, say, mahalo, his staff is doing a great job.
Chinatown does have a rich history. We did stories this year. This is the 125th anniversary of the Great Chinatown Fire, the history about the bubonic plague and all of that, and how the merchants have survived and thrived in that area.
Oh, yeah. If you look at Chinatown, it's not really Chinatown. You don't see Chinese living in there. I've been telling people, the Chinese were there, the Japanese were there, the Vietnamese were there, and a lot of people didn't realize the Filipino were living there for many, many years. When I came to Hawaii back in 1960, when I visited Chinatown, you got nothing but Filipino plantation workers retire. They have no money. They're living on the second floor as tenement.
Yes.
They share a room with a whole bunch of people, and the weekend, not weekend, but when they got the money, Social Security, they be shooting pool downstairs. all the bars be bustling. I still remember that when I was a kid. Even now, it's great. I wish we can do something for the evening. But right now, I'm working on daytime right now, activities. So when we can accomplish that, maybe we'll talk to the mayor to do something for the evening.
Yeah, you want the synergy to happen throughout the day to revitalize that area.
Oh, yeah. That place is exciting because I'm telling you, Chinatown is really exciting. If you have a chance, go down there. When you see me, say hi to me because you'll see me there all the time. I've been there this weekend every day.
So tell us about this fundraising effort that you're trying to launch, because you've got the permits now, but you've got to make this happen.
Yes. If you look into my website, HonoluluChinatown.org, HonoluluChinatown.org, you see what we're doing, and we have formed for donation. We're looking for donation to help us to build the mall, the Chinatown Arch, but I already have commitment from a couple of my friends and myself, too. And I told the mayor, I will do whatever I can. So it will be built by summer of next year. I am very confident.
We have seen little areas getting revitalized. I know we're hoping that the WOFAT building will be completed and finally open. There was wonderful murals on the side of that building just to give it new life.
Oh, yeah. Guess who did the murals?
Yeah.
I worked on that 2 years ago. But I'm telling you, once I got all the permission to paint murals in Kekalike Mall, the tourists will come. And once I have my marketing team start working on it, my daughter doesn't like it. I say, hey, you cannot use all my staff at L&L office. I said, no, I got to use it. But I plan to hire people to help me in the future because I'm kind of retired. But my focus right now is to help Chinatown. I was brought up in Chinatown. I love Chinatown.
Will you have any special events to kick this off or to help support it?
Right now, we don't have any special events, but when the lanterns arrive, I just bought 100 red lanterns, and they will be placed in Keikaliki Mall, hopefully in about a month or 2 months. We're waiting for the shipment from China. So as soon as it arrives, boy, I'm telling you, that Keikaliki Mall is going to be beautiful.
Okay, hopefully you got that order in before the tariffs kick in.
You have a chance to look at my website, honoluchinatown.org, and look at the arch. And I'm telling you, this is a very unusual art. It's not a typical Chinese art. In fact, it was designed by Andrew Tang. He has a lot of experience in Amsterdam, and he's doing almost pro bono for us. It's very contemporary, very modern, and I'm pretty sure it will win a lot of awards. This will attract a lot of tourists, and even local people would come and see it.
We have been hearing from Eddie Flores Jr. about the Chinatown Arch that he hopes to see rising soon at Keikaliki Mall and King Street in Honolulu. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to celebrate the Postal Service as it marks 250 years of delivering our mail. And in light of the recent decision to eliminate federal funding for public media, HPR will begin an on-air campaign tomorrow. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.